News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Before we get to our interview this afternoon, I have some news to pass along to you from the Associated Press. The Air Force says dereliction of duty charges will be dismissed against an Illinois pilot in a friendly fire case. The pilot accidentally bombed Canadian soldiers in Afghanistan in 2002, killing four of them. We'll have more on this story during the 2:30 newscast this afternoon, and also during All Things Considered, which is coming up later this afternoon. All Things Considered begins at 4. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. We're going to talk about Colombia this afternoon in this portion of the program. Colombia is a country that has been ravaged by a decades-long civil war involving rebels, paramilitary groups, and the government. It is one of the most dangerous countries in the world, according to an article on the Human Rights Watch website. Last year, human rights groups registered more than 2,500 killings of civilians as a result of political violence. Each day, an average of 650 people were forced to flee their homes. Torture remains commonplace. On the program today, we'll take a look at Colombia through the eyes of two aid workers from the Mennonite Central Committee, Bonnie Klassen and Rodolfo Jimenez. Bonnie is the committee's country representative in Colombia. She has lived in Colombia for 6 years working for peace, relief, and development. She's a founding member of the Permanent Assembly of Civil Society for Peace, and she serves on the Assembly's executive board. Bonnie is in Champaign to speak this evening, the 24th of June, at the First Mennonite Church at 902 West Springfield Avenue in Urbana. She'll speak this evening at 7:30. Rodolfo is the Mennonite Central Committee's Great Lakes representative for Illinois and Wisconsin. He's a board member of Assets, an agency that involves volunteer entrepreneurs in training people who want to be in business for themselves. He, by the way, traveled to Colombia late last year. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Bonnie, Rodolfo, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The first thing I'd like to know is about how you came to do the work that you do. Bonnie, you want to start?
Well, as I was finishing my university degree in Ontario, the option to go to a country like Colombia that was in conflict arose, and I think that at the time I felt excited about the opportunity to do something concrete for building peace somewhere in this world. After going to Colombia, I was struck very deeply by the intensity of the conflict and the pain that the people are suffering. And I was very much inspired by the work that many, many peace groups and churches are doing to change the situation, to continue to create new options and alternatives for peace. And I felt that I wanted to commit myself to working with them mm-hmm. for peace in Colombia.
Are you a Canadian?
I am, actually.
And Rodolfo, how did you come to do the work that you do?
I've known the Mennonite Church for some time, and Mennonite Central Committee is an agency that spreads goodwill, and it does that in a way that comes with no strings attached. And to me, it's a wonderful way to express your faith, and it's a great privilege for me to work in an agency like that.
And now today you're headquartered in Chicago?
Yes, I have an office in Chicago that helps congregations in Illinois and Wisconsin to understand the work of MCC.
Yeah. Outside of Colombia, what kind of work does the Mennonite Central Committee do?
We have worked over 53 countries, and even presently we are providing assistance in the disaster in Haiti. And besides that, we also have a relief work in Iraq and other parts of Europe and Africa. And we are very pleased to know that our basic aid that we provide is appreciated by common people. We send buckets with basic hygiene articles, towels, and it's great to experience the reception of these articles. These days, a person that wants to get a towel in Iraq has to work for 2 weeks and has to give all that pay just for one single towel. So they really appreciate our help.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about Colombia. Maybe we should begin with some background. Bonnie, what should we know about the history of Colombia and the roots of the violence we see today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very important to try to understand better the complexity of the situation in Colombia. Often here in North America, we hear about drugs, we hear about coffee, and we get the idea that the situation in Colombia is all about a drug war. But actually, the history of the conflict goes far back, far, far further than the involvement of drugs in Colombia. For two centuries, there has been violent conflict in Colombia as different groups are struggling to have power. In 1948, a civil war began, and that lasted for about 10 years. Between conservatives and liberals, two political parties that were struggling for control over the whole country. When that ended, many poor people felt that after 10 years of fighting, their lives remained equally miserable. Colombia is a wealthy country in many ways. There's a lot of wealth, but the vast majority of the population lives in very precarious situations. 66% of the population lives with less than $2 a day. And that means that they become desperate to be included in the wealth of the country rather than excluded. Some people decided that they wanted to try to find alternatives to have a better life. But in the mid-1960s, in their alternative communities, they were bombed by the Colombian government with support from the U.S. government, and they decided to form guerrilla groups to use violent means to take over power and redistribute the wealth in the country to benefit other kinds of people and not just the wealthy families, the few wealthy families that have had control for so many decades and centuries, really. So the guerrilla groups formed in the 1960s, and they've been, two of them have remained actively fighting on a national level up until today. In the 1980s, some of the wealthy landowners, large corporations, and the government itself formed paramilitary groups to work with the state military in some sectors to fight against these guerrillas. And that's made the conflict very complex between guerrillas, paramilitaries, and the state military forces. The civilian population gets caught in the middle of these armed groups that are fighting for control over land and wealth. Now, the drug situation is real. It is a real problem in Colombia. One of the reasons, or the the main reason why Colombians have become involved in growing coca and trafficking, transporting it to the United States and other countries in Europe is because they have no other economic options. Farmers that try to grow food crops or other cash crops like coffee are not making enough to make a living. They generally lose money when they try to transport their crops into markets. And unfortunately, people are willing to pay a lot of money for coca leaves, and so it becomes the only viable option they have.
Yeah. Well, what is your perspective on the role of drugs and drug money and the violence in Colombia? Has the money from drugs changed the political struggle in Colombia, and has it changed over time, over the last couple of decades?
Yeah, I think that certainly drug money has made the conflict much more complicated, and it makes the violent conflict sustainable. In many countries where there's violent conflict, after a few decades, all the sides of the conflict run out of money to keep going. But in Colombia, drug money, the amount of money that gets back into Colombia is sufficient to keep all the armed groups fighting for a long time yet. And it's important to understand that all the armed groups in Colombia, the guerrillas, the paramilitaries, and even indirectly the state forces are receiving money from the drug trade. So it keeps them all going.
Yeah. Well, there's profits from the drugs mm-hmm. that go into the paramilitaries' pockets and the guerrillas' pockets. And mm-hmm. also the state of Colombia, the government, is receiving aid from the United States to eradicate the problem. So everyone is benefiting except for the people on the ground who are in harm's way.
Exactly. I mean, even the U.S. aid is it's military aid. So what that does is it puts more guns, more weapons, a more military strategy into this burning fire. And as far as we're concerned, from the civilian population's perspective, it's just simply adding fuel in the fire because it increases the militarization, it increases the strength of military solutions rather than trying to finally sit down and talk and find peaceful solutions to the conflict.
Yeah. Well, that drug problem is huge. How do you attack it?
Well, you know, there's a lot of studies that have shown that if we were to look at the problem of drug users here in the United States, that they're addicted. They need medical or psychological assistance in order to overcome their addiction. As long as there are people addicted to drugs, as long as there are people that are becoming new users of drugs because of those that are pushing it on them here on the streets in U.S. cities, as long as there's that demand, somewhere in the world there'll be a supply. In the last number of years, the drug policy coming out of the United States has been focused on the supply side of the problem, on trying to eradicate the coca leaf that is processed to make cocaine. But not enough has been done, very little has been done, to look at the demand side of the equation. And, you know, if we look at basic economics, you have to look at both sides of the equation. And by eradicating a leaf in some part of Colombia with the aerial fumigations, once you move it out of one part, other parts of the country or some of the neighboring countries will simply begin to grow coca leaves because there are still people here in the United States that are willing to pay for drugs and pay a lot of money for it. And it's kind of like a balloon. When you push one side of it mm-hmm. and try to get the air to one side of a balloon, another part of the balloon just gets bigger.
Yeah. I read an article in the New York Times recently that said, as the U.S. also squishes on the balloon in terms of interdiction, mm-hmm. The drugs are going elsewhere in the world.
That's
so
right.
There are markets opening up elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, and so you're simply involving a greater number of small farmers, a greater number of people looking for economic alternatives in the problem. Rather than reducing the problem, it's getting bigger.
Yeah. Back to the violence that is there on the ground in Colombia. I've read that drug-related crime is now the most common cause of death after cancer in Colombia. Is that true?
Well, I wouldn't think that would be really the case. There is a lot of generalized violence that could be related to drugs, or it could be related to family violence, it could be related to neighborhood violence, because after so many decades, such a long armed conflict in Colombia, it is true that that violence has become a way to solve problems for many people in society, and that is a huge problem. However, a lot of the violence is still directly or indirectly connected to the armed conflict in general that, again, has its roots far deeper than just the drug problem, has its roots really in the fact that most people have been excluded from the possibilities to have a decent income. Hmm. Enough to survive on.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign County. So let's go and talk with our caller this afternoon. Go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Can you update us on what's happening on the Hill in Congress? Are you up on that? I know that Senator Byrd was going to offer a bill limiting the number of contractors, as they're called. Mm-hmm. Apparently, people should know that Iraq isn't the only place in the world where contractors are being used. They're actually were introduced to keep the number of actual military personnel down, which I think is supposedly going to be limited to 600, which is a small increase from what it was, and they wanted to double it, and now there's a big argument. There has been some progress made on the Hill, but I don't know what's happened lately. A lot of these contractors are doing fairly questionable thing, and they have the same problem. Jan Schakowsky, who is really good in Evanston, Illinois, some of the Chicago listeners should give her some support for her activism on Columbia and more generally on this military contractor problem. Can you address some of that?
Yes, I was actually in Washington about 3 weeks ago, right after some of the first votes on the troop cap issue, and it's correct. Up until now, there's been a cap of up to 400 troops and 400 contractors in Colombia, military contractors. The proposal was to either double that or take away the cap and allow unlimited U.S. troops in Colombia. Fortunately, there have been a significant number of legislators who have realized that increasing military assistance to Colombia isn't helping the situation. They managed to keep the troop cap, I think, at either 500 or 600. That was still under debate when I was there. And I believe an amendment came through leaving the number of contractors the same at 400. So as far as we can tell, there is a little bit of an increase in military personnel involvement in Colombia, but it hasn't been as increased as much as some would have been pushing for, and we are very thankful for that. On the ground in Colombia, there's a lot of question of whether there actually is more than 400 military troops and 400 contractors. When we try to find information about that, it's always a little fuzzy how many are really on the ground, because by all the action that they're involved in and the different regions of the country that we see them, we encounter them, it seems like there may be even more than what we are officially aware of.
I've never been confident that that was an accurate figure. It's true. They are doing a lot of the defoliation, the so-called Coca War. Right. What other kind of things, since you seem to have firsthand experience of what kind of things they're up to, what are our military and our military contractors doing in Colombia?
In the areas of southern Colombia, as well as other areas where they're beginning aerial fumigations, it is always U.S. military personnel that's involved in flying the planes that they're fumigating from, alongside U.S.-financed helicopters that accompany them to shoot down any possible opposition to the aerial fumigations. Now, these planes are spraying down chemicals on areas that have been where there are coca crops, but generally the spraying has become quite indiscriminate, so they end up spraying chemicals on food crops, on water sources, and many, many people are being affected by the indiscriminate fumigation of chemicals on the areas where there is some coca, or sometimes it's a lot of coca, but the indiscriminate spraying means that they're also spraying and killing a lot of food crops. People are becoming sick, animals are dying, fish are dying, some people have even died. That's one involvement, that the U.S. troops are involved in helping to fly these planes. In other areas, they are training Colombian military troops to protect U.S. economic interests in Colombia, like the Occidental Oil Pipeline in the north part of the country, and in the so-called war against terrorism. Now, one of the things that has been very complicated in Colombia is that the military has often been, in some regions of the country, guilty of collaborating with the paramilitaries. The paramilitary troops are responsible for 70% of the human rights violation in Colombia. So by training the Colombian military, sometimes the U.S. military forces are indirectly also supporting paramilitary troops.
I was wondering, I appreciate all the good information. How much of this is going across the borders, too? I know you want to focus on Colombia, but isn't there a lot of activity in the whole Andean region? And aren't some of the, I've heard in the past that some of these, maybe the extra soldiers aren't based in Colombia, but they come across from La Mantia in Ecuador. And
mm-hmm.
So the whole region is fairly penetrated by U.S. military without a lot of comment. And Senator Durbin, I mentioned Shinikoski, Senator Durbin used to be quite good on this, but he needs more pressure. I don't know whether he's coming around. He was always quite good, and then he flipped on, and I think it was on military, the number of U.S. military being allowed to go in was one of the issues that he caved in on. Thanks again.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. You can join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Today we're taking a look at Colombia through the eyes of two aid workers from the Mennonite Central Committee, Bonnie Klassen and Rodolfo Jimenez. Bonnie is based in Bogota in Colombia. She has lived in Colombia for 6 years working for peace, relief, and development. And Rodolfo is the Mennonite Central Committee's Great Lakes representative for Illinois and Wisconsin. He's a board member of ASSETS, which is an agency that involves volunteer entrepreneurs and training people who want to be in business for themselves. He also keeps the church members in Illinois and Wisconsin up to date on the committee's work around the world. And he traveled to Colombia late last year, I believe in November. What did you see? Share with us your observations being in Colombia late last year.
Well, I was impressed by the great number of displaced people seeking jobs and their general attitude of wanting to find decent and honest work. And through the work of Bonnie, we were able to have interviews with ex-combatants who, to my surprise, they indicated that they had been in combat for 8 years and they looked like teenagers. Mm-hmm. So I was really impressed by their lack of preparation for real life and by their desire to be incorporated in normal life, having a family, having a home. And being from the United States, I was really surprised at my own lack of knowledge of the situation there. I have had friends from Colombia who were just like normal persons. They never said anything about the violence and the situation there. So I was really surprised and shocked to find that the Colombian society is very militarized and filled with violence.
Yeah. Also, it seems that speaking out in Colombia is very, extremely dangerous. Human rights groups have been called spokespeople for the guerrillas, for the FARC. Bonnie, you're nodding your head. Bring us up to date on that.
Yeah, with the current government, President Uribe Vélez, he has had taken a very strong stance, a very critical stance of human rights and peace organizations that are trying to protect civilian rights to stay out of the conflict. The current president has decided to take a militarized approach to putting an end to the conflict, as he says, putting an end to it through military solutions. Although even military commanders will admit that there's no way that they will militarily defeat the guerrillas in Colombia. So those of us who are seeking negotiated political solutions are considered the enemy to the government's military policies. We have been critical of policies that are involving civilians all throughout the country and asking them to provide information or to make up false accusations against people that the government sees as a possible threat, or to act as rural soldiers, combating in their own towns and then sleeping in their homes. Well, all those kinds of policies put civilians at risk. So those human rights and peace organizations that are acting to protect civilians' rights to stay out of the conflict have been heavily criticized. Last year, publicly, the president referred to peace and human rights organizations as aiding terrorist groups. Well, that has put many human rights workers at risk, because when they are considered or labeled possible terrorist aides in public, then some of those groups in Colombia, like the paramilitaries or the military forces, will see them as a possible valid target. Human rights and peace workers have been assassinated in large numbers in Colombia. Offices are being raided. In the last year, somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 community leaders and peace workers, human rights workers, have been detained without any charge against them, held in prison for any number of months, and then released. We feel that we are under attack in many ways. Recently, last week, there was an attack by the FARC on civilian, about 34 civilians that were attacked in their sleep. We recognize very clearly that that's a terrible violation of human rights. The president, instead of focusing on attending to these victims, their families' needs, he publicly spoke out against human rights and peace organizations, and again said that we were not doing enough.
Mm. You know, to go to one of the things that you talked about here, about how how people are caught in the middle of guerrilla groups and the paramilitary, and the paramilitaries are clearly, there's clearly a link with the army mm-hmm. and the government. I read an account of Catholic priests being targeted by both groups as they tried to maybe help farmers move from one part of an area to another. The guerrilla groups demand that their rifles be blessed. Mm-hmm. And so the priest is threatened if he's not going to, when he refuses to bless the rifles. And another priest was seen as getting too cozy to the guerrillas, and he found two hand grenades underneath the hood of his car. So it's a horrible, horrible situation. I also want to, we got a couple other callers here who I want to get to pronto, but first I want to talk about the issue of displacement. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very important issue. I mentioned at the outset, millions of people have been displaced. When did that displacement begin, and what's the situation for those people?
Well, displacement has been a reality in Colombia for decades as well. Again, in the Civil War in the 1940s and 50s, a million people were displaced from their homes then. So it's not a new problem. But in the last 15 years, around 3 million people have been forced to flee from their homes. And this displacement, the rate of displacement began to increase alarmingly in the mid and late 1990s. In 2001, 2002, around 1,000 people a day were being forced to flee from their homes, which has created an enormous humanitarian crisis in Colombia. Unfortunately, the response has been very insufficient, inadequate in terms of trying to help displaced people rebuild their lives. They are forced to flee from their homes. Often from one day to the next, they're given, 12 hours to get out of the town where they are living in. They are forced to flee then without anything but the clothes on their back, and they arrive in cities disoriented, without any way to gain any kind of income to make a living. They are often discriminated against because they are seen as sort of signs of the violence that is so intense in the countryside and cities. Sometimes we'd like to forget that that's such a reality in our own country.
Rodolfo mentioned children soldiers. This mm-hmm. movement, I would imagine that this displacement feeds into that.
Exactly, because both in the countryside and in the city, when children are left without any options, when there are no schools available for them to study, there are no job options for them to do some sort of of income-generating work, they are left without anything to do. Their families are pressured for them to join the armed groups. Recent reports have shown that there are at least 10,000 child soldiers in Colombia.
Let's talk with some listeners now. First, we're going to go to another caller in Champaign County, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm surprised at how much, though you call yourself a peace group and Mennonite group, you seem to be taking the side of the FARC, and occasionally you criticize them, but for the most part you're criticizing the government, whereas from what I hear and read about it, it seems like the FARC is continuing, and its allied groups continuing to perpetuate violence, spread violence, use bombing and all sorts of terror tactics, and yet you seem to almost justify it and give rationalizations and causes and constantly criticize the government for trying to stop this violence. I wonder if there's a one-sided approach there where you feel okay to criticize the government but really don't come out very strong against FARC.
No, by no means am I condoning or in any way supportive of the many tactics of terror that have been used by the insurgent, the guerrilla groups, both the FARC and the ELN in Colombia. We're an organization that is very much working for nonviolent methods of bringing an end to the conflict in Colombia. Perhaps one of the reasons that I will make comments about the government in particular is because they are also using violent forms of trying to put an end to the conflict, whereas we would hope that the government would work to protect civilian population rather than involving them in the conflict. But of course, we are equally condemning the violence that is perpetuated by the insurgent groups. In many ways, it's very clear in Colombia that the insurgent groups, the guerrilla groups, the FARC, the ELN, and just like the paramilitaries, have degraded their tactics to such a degree that it is impossible to sympathize with their methods. It is impossible to sympathize with their way of operating.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line 1. Good afternoon.
Thank you. This is a very interesting program. Thank you very much. I am from Colombia, and I was there last year. Mm. And my question is about a piece of news I heard last week that Colombia was considered one of the 4 worst offenders when it came to groups like Amnesty International or the relief workers to go and try to help the people that are displaced or caught in the middle. And the other country that I remember was mentioned was Sudan. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, I know that things are bad, but I was wondering, that related to what you said earlier about that you guys were under attack and were not protected by the government, or if you have any other, do you know anything about the criterion that was used to, because it sounds pretty bad. I'll hang up on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, I believe that Colombia does continue to appear, according to statistics, as a very complicated place for people working for peace and human rights. It is the top country in the world in terms of journalists assassinated, the top country in the world in terms of union workers assassinated. And so for those who are working for change in nonviolent ways, without using guns, without using weapons, they are often being attacked by all sides of the conflict, both the guerrillas, the paramilitaries, and the military forces. As I mentioned, all sides of the conflict are pressuring those in civilian societies to take sides. And so those of us that are trying to say we do not want to take sides in this conflict, we want to work for peace using nonviolent means, not using military methods, we are continually accused by any side of the conflict of being on the other side and then considered the enemy. Again, I'm critical of the government in that sense because, the state, the legitimate authority in the government in any given country, is responsible for protecting civilians' rights to stay out of the conflict.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 2 in Belgium, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Since early in your discussion, you said drugs seem to play a very important role in this whole situation. Maybe some of the solving of this problem can easily be put at the doorstep of the United States. Rather stupid and draconian drug laws make an intelligent modification so that we don't export our problem to Colombia.
Well, there are studies that show that it would be even 22 times more cost-effective and simply more effective in terms of having real results. So focusing efforts on drug rehabilitation and more effective education to prevent new young people from using drugs.
Well, I was thinking more in the line of decriminalization, ma'am, mm-hmm. so that we would buy all the product and give the money that goes to the proper people in Colombia so that people have a good life standard. We wouldn't be putting it into people who just want to make weapons and kill people. And then at this end of the story, we'd have pharmacists pass it out to the drug addicts for nothing, so we'd get rid of the drug dealers in our own country. Sounds like an interesting solution, wouldn't you think?
Well, you know, I think it's time, after all the problems that we've seen with the policies that have existed that haven't been effective, that we start exploring creative alternative methods.
And I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got some other people waiting. Let's go next to a listener on line 3 in Eureka, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I think I know the answer to the question, but I guess I just would like to hold a little hope in my mind. Is there anything that our government has done that is positive to make the situation better, or is, in your view, mostly negative?
Yeah, there has been a lot of negative things. And I do want to affirm the U.S. Embassy in its work in trying to speak out against some of the violations against human rights workers. Earlier this year, my former boss was being – his name is Ricardo Esquivia. He was being falsely accused of using violent methods in his work for change. He's somebody committed to nonviolence, so the accusations were ridiculous. The U.S. Embassy, for example, in that case, it did all that it could to pressure the Colombian government and the military to not arrest him and to not falsely accuse him. We have a good relationship with the embassy, and they have tried to help us in some of those issues. However, the U.S. still is sending $2.5 billion worth of largely military aid that is causing a lot of death rather than life.
It almost seems like our current president is creating the same kind of climate here, and with patriotism is equated with blind obedience, probably not the violence. Thank you very much. You're doing an excellent job.
Thank you.
What is public opinion on the streets and in the countryside of Colombia? And who has the vote? Who's voting? Who is unable to vote?
Well, Colombia is considered to be a democratic society. However, it is very difficult for the average citizen to have a real involvement in decision-making and politics in the country. I think a lot of people have, both in Colombia and, of course, outside of the country, have a lack of information about what is going on in the rural parts where people are suffering the direct effects of violence. In rural areas, people are being pressured and threatened violently to take one or another opinion, political opinion. So often when they vote, when they can vote, they vote because if they don't vote in that direction, whatever direction it is, they'll be assassinated or they'll be forced to flee from their homes. In the average election, there's maybe 20 million people that can vote. Only half actually do go out and vote. And another reason for that is because rural areas tend to be very remote and very difficult to have transportation into voting centers. It makes it difficult for people to participate. Those that try to present alternatives, alternative political parties, have faced a lot of repression. And thousands of political leaders from alternative parties have been assassinated in the last number of years. So people are sometimes also just simply afraid.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 1 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi. I understand that there is an effort native to Colombia and is longstanding and I think very successful for the development of appropriate technology to mm-hmm. help especially the rural people to improve their situation
mm-hmm.
at a place called Gaviotas.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you've had contact with them and whether you know how they're doing in recent times.
Well, unfortunately, I personally have not had direct contact with the community in Las Gaviotas. I understand that they continue to develop new alternatives for their development. And there are also many other communities in Colombia who are trying to build alternatives, that are trying to strengthen their own local governance and remain independent from the armed groups. In the level that they can remain independent, autonomous from the armed groups, they can also develop their own economic possibilities in their own communities.
The last that I knew, the people at Gaviotas had in fact managed to, as you say, remain autonomous, that the guerrillas often come through, but they don't do any harm.
That's correct. I think to the extent that communities can show a clear stance for nonviolence, they can slowly gain the respect of all the armed groups. And in that sense, nonviolence becomes a form of protection.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. It's good to have a little good news. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're coming down on time here this afternoon. I got a couple of questions for both of you. What does give you hope? And to those folks who are listening this afternoon and wondering, gee, is there something I might do to foster nonviolence in Colombia, what can they do?
Yeah, I think there are many small communities, church groups, community organizations, and some NGOs in Colombia that are making small changes. They are creating jobs, that are helping small farmers continue to grow alternative crops, that are providing education, that are teaching nonviolence to children so that they will not choose to join any of their armed groups. Hope comes out of these small initiatives. Peace does not just happen from the top down. Peace happens when people in communities all over the country begin to live peacefully among themselves.
Yes, that goes back to something you said earlier, Rodolfo, about the children that have quit fighting. After, you know, they're teenagers now. They're still children, but they've put down their guns. That's got to be something that, as you mentioned, I think gives you great hope. How is it that those kids did that? How were they able to say, no more fighting?
Yes, the church has a training program that enables kids to think of approaching conflict in a non-violent way. And to me, that's a great source of hope. I saw the pastor that is doing that. He's, by the way, an excellent chef. He's a very good cook. And he is involved in teaching non-violent methods to people. And to me, that's a lot of source of hope. Another source of hope for me is to see communities here in the United States that are doing sister congregation relationships with congregations in Colombia. And Bonnie was mentioning recently how these people in Colombia are encouraged by calls from congregations in Sunday afternoons, and how they also are able to provide information back to communities here and give them real information coming from the common people. And when you receive information that is factual, that is not filtered through the news, our news system here, that also provides a lot of strengthening in your own faith, and you feel motivated to help out people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great also source of hope for people there and here.
Speaking of things that we might do, Bonnie, from your point of view, what would you like to see Americans do in terms of getting in touch with their representatives? And you know, what kind of action would you like to see those lawmakers, those policymakers take in terms of improving, perhaps making improvements in Colombia through U.S.-American policy?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were to ask a Colombian community that has been affected by the U.S. policy of fumigations and military assistance, people in those communities would say very clearly, stop fumigating us, please stop sending chemicals to spray on us. And they would say, instead of sending guns, instead of sending helicopters, please help to buy our products at fair prices, help us develop infrastructure, roads, schools, health systems, a better justice system, to make real conditions for a sustainable kind of peace, and rather than just an ongoing war.
There we have to leave it. I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us this afternoon. Our guests have been Bonnie Klassen and Rodolfo Jimenez. They are with the Mennonite Central Committee. Bonnie, by the way, will be speaking this evening, the 24th of June, at the First Mennonite Church at 902 West Springfield Avenue in Urbana. She'll speak at 7:30 this evening. And also you can find more examples of the work that the Mennonite Central Committee does on the World Wide Web. Just put the Mennonite Central Committee into your browser, and there you will be. Again, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Also, thanks to our callers this afternoon for their questions and comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
8 minutes before 2 o'clock, we should have settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, the bean futures continue to trade higher today. That on ideas that the crop is still short here in the Midwest, at least in terms of the old crop, and that pushed the beans higher. The corn and the wheat actually were a bit lower on ideas that the crop that's in the ground is in fairly good conditions. There aren't really any weather problems on the way in the Midwest, although there are some calls for some dry conditions, but it's been fairly wet across a large portion of the corn belt, and traders are thinking that the crop should be in fairly good condition. I must tell you, though, I took a little trip south of Champaign down to Philo for lunch today, and as I was making that run, I thought, hey, you know, this cold weather looks to me like it may have stopped growth, or at least really slowed down the growth of the corn. We'll see how that turns out in the crop conditions reports when they come out next Monday, and you can be sure to tune in to Dave Dickey next Tuesday morning to hear all about that. July wheat now at the Board of Trade. High 345.5, a low at 338. A settlement price there at 339.5, down 5.75. The September 354.5, the high, the low at 346.5. A settlement price there at 348.25. They were down 6. And December futures in the wheat pit, 365, the high, the low at 358. A settlement price 359, down 6 cents. The March contract, 372, the high, the low at 367. Settlement price at 368.75, down 4.25 on the day. May contract in the wheat pit, 373, the high, the low at 370.5, settled on that low, down 2.5 cents for the day. From the corn pit now, 276.5, the high, the low at 271.75, settlement price at 273.25. They were a penny and a quarter lower. By the way, they're probably marking a bit of time as they're waiting for that crop acreage report due out from USDA next Wednesday. September corn, 281.5, the high, the low at 276.5. September settled 277.75, down a penny and a half for the day. December futures in the corn pit, 285.5, the high, the low at 280.5. Your new crop settled 282.5 in the December contract, down 1.75 on the day. March futures now, 290.75, the high, the low at 286.5, settled 288, a penny and 3/4 lower. And the May futures, 295, the high, the low 291, settled 292.75, down 2.25. July futures in the corn pit, 295.5, the high, the low at 292.75, settlement price at 293.5, down 2 cents. In the September futures for next year, 280.5, high, low at 280, settled 280.5, down a penny and a half. In December of 2005, a settlement price there, down a penny and a half, the high at 269.5, a low and a settlement both at 268. July oats, 149. The high, the low at 144.5, a settlement price at 145.25, down a penny and 3/4. In September futures, 154.25 high, the low at 149.5, settlement price at 150.5, and they were down a penny and a half for the day. Squeezes on in the bean pits as the old crop continues to be very, very scarce out there, and traders and those looking to source some beans are still fighting for them. Not too terribly bad at this point, but some analysts are thinking it may go a bit higher yet. July beans, 940, the high, the low at 912.25, settled 921.5, they're up 4. August, 870, the high, the low at 841. Settlement price there at 848, up 4.5 cents. In September's, 755, the high, the low at 733. Settlement price at 740.5. They're up 3 cents for the day. November contract is a little surprisingly. New crop beans up 5 cents today. 707, the high, the low at 692. Settlement price at 699. We'll find out why that was the case from Dan Zwicker this afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. That's just a few minutes away. 706, the high in the January beans. The low at 694.5. Settled at $7 even, up 6.5 cents in the May. 694, the high, the low at 680. 5, and the settlement price there at 687, up 4. Let me correct that. The January is a high of 706, a low at 694.5, a settlement price at $7.5. They were up 6. The March contract they missed, 705, the high, the low at 692, settled $6 even. They were up 6.5. July bean meal now, 316 high, low at 303, settled 306, up 140. And the August, a settlement price at 290, even up 240. July bean oil up 19 for the day at 29.40. And the August contract settled 28.52. They were up 36. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. Cattle prices were mostly higher, while lean hogs and July bellies finished on the downside. Let's take a look now at the livestock prices. August feeder cattle, the high 113.90, the low 112.85, the settlement 113.72.5, that up 115. September feeder cattle, 112, the high 110.50, the low 111.87.5, the settlement, that up 157.5. October feeder cattle, 110 the high, 108.25 the low, 109.95 the settlement, that up 195. June live cattle, 90.20 the high, 89.40 the low, 90 even the settlement, that up 142.5. July live cattle, 89.30 the high, 89.20 the low, 89.20 the settlement, that down 80. August live cattle, 90.25 the high, 89.10 the low, 89.82.5 the settlement, that up 65. July lean hog, 78 even the high, 76.30 the low, 76.60 the settlement, that down 152.5. August, 76.50 the high, 74.50 the low, 74.87.5 the settlement, that down 155. October, 65.75 the high, 64.20 the low, 64.35 the settlement, that down 135. December lean hog, 60.75 the high, the low 59.50, the settlement 59.75, that down 95. July bellies, 117.90 the high, 115.40 the low, 115.95 the settlement, that down 135. The Dow is off 22 points, the NASDAQ off 2, so too the S&P 500, it's off 2 points.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from Risk Management Commodities, with offices in Hudsonville, Illinois, Chalmers, and Lafayette, Indiana. Risk Management Commodities provides commodities analysis and recommendations for business and agriculture throughout East Central Illinois and Western Indiana. For more information, call 866-837-9027 or 877-433-4348.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Doris Lestoyle from Ann Arbor, Michigan writes, "Dear Dr. Science, you'll have to excuse me. I'm not used to writing to a celebrity. And the possibility that my question might be read over the air to an entire nation full of people who are brushing their teeth, hurrying off to work, driving just this certain route day after day, and if they don't hear Ask Dr. Science just as they're driving under this particular bridge,